Welcome to Between the Leaves at the Lloyd, a podcast of the Lloyd Library and Museum, located in downtown Cincinnati, Ohio. This fall, Lloyd Library is exploring all things mycological in an exhibit and series of events called A Foray into Fungi. Mushrooms are the first thing that come to my mind when fungi is mentioned, but the world of fungi isn't just mushrooms. It's so much more. The fungi kingdom is vast and diverse. Yeasts, molds, mildews, and slime, all fungi. Fungi are food and medicine. They're in and on us. They're networks of mycelium underground. We're excited to have Dr. Nicholas Money with us today to help us explore more of this fascinating world. Dr. Money is a mycologist, author, and professor of biology at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He's an expert on fungal biology and has authored a dozen popular science books celebrating the microbial world. Welcome to Between the Leaves, Dr. Money. We're so happy to have you here today.
Oh, good to talk with you.
Yeah. So fungi were originally considered plants, but then they were placed in their own kingdom. Why is that?
So historically, fungi have been treated as plants. And when there were more academic mycologists, they tended to work in departments of botany. And so that reflects then this idea that the fungi were a form of strange form of plant life. But historically, fungi have also been thought of as more animal-like in their behavior. And some of the early microscopists that looked at the fungi saw their hyphae, these filamentous cells under the microscope, and they saw the cytoplasm, the contents of those cells shuttling back and forth. And they describe them as polyp-like organisms, something more like perhaps, I don't know, sponges or some kind of strange marine animal. And so the whole nature of the fungi was at least disputed for many centuries. But we know now, as you said, that they occupy their own particular part of the phylogenetic tree, the tree of life.
Do we share anything in common with fungi?
We share lots in common with the fungi. I mean, plants make their own food by photosynthesis. They use the energy from sunlight to capture carbon dioxide from the air, and they make their own sugars and other substances. Fungi work more like us. They feed on other organisms. So they break down the tissues of plants and animals. And so they act like us nutritionally, that they're feeding on things in their environment rather than making their own food.
Well, when did you first become interested in fungi, and how did your interest evolve?
So I became interested in fungi when I went to university. I grew up in Britain. I went to college at Bristol University in the UK. When did I go there? 1980. And that was really the first time that I encountered the fungi. One of the professors there in really the first lecture that I went to in biology was talking about fungi, and I found him very, very attractive in many ways, and this description of the fungi as a different form of life. I mean, nothing really prepared me for this, and I found this just fascinating and just fell in love with the whole field of mycology then at the age of 18. And then I worked in that professor's lab a little later on, and then here we are decades later, and I'm still interested in fungi.
Did you spend a lot of time outdoors as a child to instill your love of or your interest in biology in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is something that I think biologists of my generation, many of us share this childhood encounter with nature. And for me, that came via my grandmother on my mom's side. And she took me and my sister into the woods from a very early age and sort of forced biology upon us. She'd had no formal education, but she knew the name of every plant and animal. And she took us fossil collecting too, which was fascinating. And so, yeah, that was really how my interest in natural history began. It was through those nature walks with my grandma.
Wonderful. I think a lot of us do share that experience. So fungi are ubiquitous in nature. Talk about their role in the web of life here on Earth.
Fungi are indeed, they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. We're surrounded by them. They're present inside our bodies, and perhaps we'll talk more about that. But they're everywhere in nature, and the fundamental role that they play is within the carbon cycle. They spin the carbon cycle. So they break down materials produced by other organisms. They're the agents of decomposition. They're the agents of entropy. They're breaking down complicated materials to form smaller molecules that they then use as fuel for their own metabolism. So this is really what they're doing in every location where we find fungi. They're breaking down materials. They're the great decomposers.
Tell us about fungi in and on our bodies. And what is the microbiome?
So most people have heard of the microbiome. And that's a description that's really been reserved for the most part for the trillions of bacteria that exist in our digestive systems, mostly in the gut. But the microbiome is the fungal part of that microbial community, which is a very, very rich assemblage of microorganisms. So it's not just bacteria. There are smaller numbers of fungal cells that live in the gut, but they're also in and on every other part of the body. So our skin is colonized by yeasts, and particularly the scalp. The scalp's an area where yeasts multiply, and they're growing on, they're breaking down the sebum that we secrete onto the scalp, so this waxy material that we weep over our hairs. The fungi love this. This is their food source. And so that's one place where we find them. But one would be hard placed to find any location on the human body where we didn't find fungi. So that's the microbiome, or at least the part of the microbiome that's in contact with us physically.
Do we know much about the role of fungi in the greater microbiome? Do we know what they're doing in our bodies?
That's a great question, because for many years, the fungi was sidelined. We didn't really, or there was very little known about what they were doing in the body, or even what kinds of fungi were present. But as the techniques have evolved over the last few years, I mean, relatively recently, there's all there are many experiments now that are showing that fungi are indeed playing a very, very important role in the human body and within the microbiome. They're working with bacteria. They're also interacting with our immune system in a very profound way. And so this is very new science.
Oh, how interesting. I guess that will be something interesting to watch in the next few years. Just curious, my granddaughter had eczema. Is fungus in any way related to eczema on the body?
So there's believed to be a fungal connection in eczema in the following sense, that when we look at children with different allergic conditions, and so eczema is a very complicated ailment, but indeed allergy is a big part of this, that we find that those children are very reactive to fungal proteins. So it could be that exposure to fungi is stimulating or exacerbating that condition. And so that doesn't mean sort of a direct line between fungal exposure and eczema, but they're probably part of that story. And we see this in many other illnesses too.
So fungi have played an important role in medicine. The first and maybe most important antibiotic was developed from a mold. Tell us about that.
Yes, penicillin. So the first of the antibiotics was discovered by Alexander Fleming in the 1920s. And penicillin is produced by a mold, a filamentous fungus called Penicillium. And this was the beginning of the antibiotic revolution. And then since then, many different medicines have been isolated from fungi. So they play a really important role in modern pharmacology.
And you have a book coming out soon that is about the effects of fungi on human health. Will we hear more about these topics? And what's its title and when will it be out?
Yeah, so this book is called Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicine, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. And it's going to be published by Princeton University Press. And it will be out in March of next year. So reserve your copy now.
We'll do that. I saw online that some of your research relates to asthma. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm an asthmatic myself, and I suffered from quite severe asthma as a child. So we were talking about eczema earlier. And so like eczema, there's a fungal connection in asthma. And in fact, children that suffer from asthma are very reactive to materials, proteins that are carried on the surface of fungal spores. And so we think about asthma and also other conditions like allergic rhinitis or hay fever. We think about the role of plants in those illnesses by inhaling pollen, but fungal spores are perhaps equally important. And so I'm fascinated by that fungal connection. And then in terms of research that I've done, I've been very interested in the way that fungal spores get into the air and therefore are part of our air supply. And so I've studied cellular mechanics during my research career. I'm very interested in those explosive mechanisms that launch spores, these little fungal particles, into the air.
Also in the realm of medicine, recently there's been a lot of interest in psilocybin for the treatment of depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues. Can you tell us about psilocybin and its use in mental health?
Yeah, it's a huge topic and creating a lot of interest right now for very good reasons. So psilocybin, which is the compound produced by some of the magic mushrooms, when we ingest psilocybin, that's converted to a chemical called psilocin. And psilocin looks very much like serotonin in terms of its chemical structure. And so one might say that it interferes with our nervous system. But for many people, it's doing so in a very positive fashion, that people that have, in some clinical trials, patients that have suffered from really severe depression and anxiety that are given psilocybin seem to really benefit from this exposure, that even just in a single dose, this is making them feel more at ease with life than really any of the conventional treatments that they may have tried. It's not for everyone. There's certainly some small subset that suffer quite negative responses when they try psilocybin or ingest magic mushrooms. But for some, for perhaps many people, this could be a very, very interesting therapy. And so we're seeing more research in this area, and we're seeing efforts to legalize the use of psilocybin in a number of states. So yeah, this is a fascinating area of fungal medicine. And it's not only in its uses for depression. There's other conditions. So there's a lot of interest in looking at the way that psilocybin may be used to treat PTSD. Recent study was published on psilocybin and anorexia. So this is a really very, very interesting area of biomedicine.
We talked about the role of fungi in medicine, but you wrote an essay titled "Are Mushrooms Medicinal?" And it seemed that you questioned the assumption that they are, and it was considered controversial, according to you. You also said in your talk at the Lloyd that the future of fungal medicine is bright. So how do those things coincide, or are they in conflict? Are those ideas in conflict? What did you mean when you said, are mushrooms medicinal?
That's a great question, because those two ideas do seem to be in conflict, and yet they're not. So first of all, with that essay, then, are mushrooms medicinal? you can look online and you'll see a lot of criticisms of that work. This was published in a peer-reviewed journal called Fungal Biology back in 2016, and it's still downloaded very frequently. The point that I was making in that article is that in terms of the scientific evidence for the usefulness of medicinal mushrooms, this is lacking. Now, there's some exceptions. There are a few interesting studies that one can point to. But if we're looking at really strong evidence in terms of placebo-controlled trials that show that eating this medicinal mushroom or taking this extract from a mushroom in the form of a capsule, that this actually helps with different health conditions, the evidence is almost entirely lacking. So there's a lot to this, and we could certainly talk further about that. But that was the point there in terms of the evidence for the usefulness of these medicines. When I say that the future of fungal medicine is bright, that takes me back to the microbiome and the idea that we're really at a cutting edge of scientific research here in terms of understanding the relationship between fungi and the human body. There's so much to be discovered here. And indeed, there are tens of billions of fungal cells passing through our guts, you know, right now. Understanding this is, to me, absolutely fascinating. And we see publications in great journals every week now on the interactions between fungi and the human immune system. So yeah, this is a really interesting area of biomedicine. I don't think that's in conflict with my overall skepticism about the significance of medicinal mushrooms in treating really serious health conditions.
So you just want to see some research done to verify that these mushrooms are actually being effective in the ways that they're being said to be. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think at the moment it's a case of buyer beware. There are extraordinary claims that are made about the efficacy of these drugs in treating, again, very serious conditions, even different forms of cancer. And the evidence isn't there. I need to see that before I'm going to be really enthusiastic about these products.
What are some of the mushrooms that are being used medicinally?
One of the most interesting ones right now is a mushroom called lion's mane. And this mushroom has the unusual property that it contains compounds that have these effects upon the nervous system, at least in experiments that have been performed on mice and experiments that have been performed on cultured cells, so isolated nerve cells. They seem to stimulate the branching and growth of these nerve cells, and they may have some ability to alter the wiring inside the brain of a mouse. But we're a long way from showing that these compounds really are effective, have an effect upon the human nervous system. But there is something there. These compounds have this profound effect upon cultured cells. Maybe this could translate into, you know, in the future, in a useful medicine that could be used to treat different forms of dementia. But even that's a huge stretch at this point. There's no scientific evidence to support that.
Okay, kind of switching gears here. There's also been a lot written in recent years about mycelium, mycorrhizal networks, and their interactions with trees and other plants. Tell us about that, and can you explain the difference between mycelium and mycorrhizae?
Okay, so mycelia, or the mycelium, that's the name for the colony that's produced by a filamentous fungus. So many fungi grow as yeasts, as sort of rounded cells that produce daughter cells, buds on their surface. But among the filamentous fungi, including those that form mushrooms, they form these underground colonies that we call mycelia, that's the plural. And these are branching filaments, microscopic threads called hyphae, and they branch at their tips. And they branch, and then the branches branch. Is that correct? The branches branch. And we get this colony that's an ever-expanding structure that grows in three dimensions. So that's the mycelium. There are some of these fungi that interact with plant roots. And so we call those mycorrhizas or mycorrhizal fungi. So in that case, the colony or mycelium is actually interconnecting with the roots of trees. And so then we get a network between the root systems of trees and then these mycelia of fungi, and it forms a whole network in the forest soil.
Hmm. And that's beneficial to trees and forests, is that right?
It's beneficial both to the trees and the fungi. It can, at its best, work as a balanced relationship where the fungus is bringing in water and nutrients from the surrounding soil and supplying the tree with these materials. So it's like an accessory root system. But the fungus is getting payment. It's drawing sugars from the tree. The tree's producing its own food by photosynthesis, and the fungus is taking payment in the form of those sugars.
So it's really symbiotic.
It's what we call a mutualistic symbiosis. It's mutually supportive. But it can also go wrong. I mean, the fungus isn't out there to sort of, it's not acting in a charitable sense towards the trees. It's doing this, it's getting payment through the nutrients that it acquires. And the relationship can become unbalanced. And then in some cases, the fungus will actually cause damage to the root system.
There's also a lot of current interest in the role that fungi might play in solving ecological issues, which are so large and looming in our world today. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're at a crisis point, maybe one of many crises points in human history, but this one's a biggie with climate change and just the degree of damage that 8 billion plus humans have wrought. Fungi are not our saviors. They're not going to fix any of the problems that we've created. But having healthy forests that include the growth of fungi is incredibly important. Without those ecosystems, without those functioning ecosystems, humans are not going to be in very good shape. So we're dependent upon them. But I think looking towards the fungi for fixes for our problems is perhaps a bit naive. I think it's an order of magnitude issue when we look at just how much damage we've done to different ecosystems. Fungi are not a quick fix.
So they're not just going to gobble up all the carbon, excess carbon for us?
Fungi actually are producing carbon dioxide because they break down materials in the environment. So in that sense, they're not going to draw down carbon dioxide like photosynthetic organisms like plants and algae. But nevertheless, they're very important through the carbon cycle, through creating some kind of a balanced relationship between carbon dioxide production and then the fixation of carbon dioxide by plants. So without the, for example, mycorrhizal connections between plants and fungi, plants are not going to be very effective at cleaning the atmosphere.
Thinking about mushrooms here in our area, how biodiverse is Greater Cincinnati and the Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky area in terms of fungi? Is this a good area for mushroom hunting and research study of mushrooms?
They're kind of two separate questions there, because we live in an area of high biodiversity, and the forests and the grasslands and the farmland too have very rich populations of fungi. But at least in southwestern Ohio, this is a bit of a frustrating place for a mycologist to live and work, because we get very dry conditions often toward the end of the summer and the early fall. And so it's hit and miss as to whether we find lots of fungi in the woods or fungal fruit bodies, mushrooms in the woods. And so right now, this year, 2023, bone dry conditions in August, and at least so far in September. And so not a lot of mushrooms in the woods. So I'm hoping for lots and lots of rain in the next few weeks.
And can we find mushrooms any time of year here?
Mushrooms can be found throughout the year, even in the depths of winter. But there's certainly some peak seasons when we've had a lot of rainfall. We have morels. We have a morel season that begins mid to late April and then runs through early May, and a lot of people are very excited about morels in the spring. And then the other best time of the year really is the fall, when we've got a lot of leaf litter on the ground and we see fungi and we see bracket fungi fruiting from decomposing logs. So yeah, it can be spectacular, but we do need a lot of rain.
Do you harvest wild mushrooms?
It's something that I have done, and there's a few things that I'll collect and eat, including wild oyster mushrooms, but I'm not very experimental in that way.
Now, I understand that you've done a lot of research at Lloyd Library, and the Lloyd has a lot of really interesting historic reference materials. Can you talk about how those materials might be significant or unique?
Yes, the Lloyd Library, it's a wonderful place for a mycologist. They have one of the richest collections of historical works on fungal biology, on mycology, really anywhere in the world. It's just a fabulous resource for somebody like me that's obsessed with the fungi. And so with a lot of the research projects that I've done, I'm always interested in what has been studied previously. And so looking at those historical sources is absolutely critical. But also the books and the manuscripts at the Lloyd Library, one can, or at least I, you know, revel in them just for their artistic qualities, these gorgeous illustrations of mushrooms. And really, it's amazing what they have there at the Lloyd Library. And I'd encourage everyone in the area to visit the Lloyd and just take a look at what they have there.
Can you give us an example, maybe, of something that might even be in the exhibit right now?
There's so many things in the exhibit that are worth taking a look at. One of the books there that the illustrations are perhaps sort of not as conspicuous as others. There's a book that was published in 1729 by mycologist, or the father of mycology, called Anton Michaeli. It's called the Nova Plantarum Genera. This is a really, really important work in terms of the history of the study of the fungi. He was one of the first people to actually carry out experiments on fungi. And the illustrations in the book are really beautiful, but they're not colored. They're these very extravagant plates, but yeah, not colored. But you should take a look at that.
What's most exciting to you about your current research and or about mycological research in general right now?
Well, with the book that I've been working on that I said is published in March, it's really exposed me to a lot of the biomedical literature on fungi and looking at the microbiome that perhaps I wouldn't have explored otherwise. And so I find this absolutely fascinating, the idea that other researchers are really in a working very, very as fast as they can to understand what these fungi are doing in the gut, for example. And could these fungi actually influence the development of different health conditions like irritable bowel syndrome and other issues? I think this is absolutely fascinating. This is really new stuff. So I find that really intriguing.
Wonderful. So we're about out of time. Is there anything that has surprised you about fungi in your research as we wrap up?
One of the things that surprised me most about the fungi in recent years has come from, I suppose, my research, but more so the work of other scientists, other mycologists, fungal biologists. And this is the evidence of the extreme sensitivity among the fungi, the way that they're extremely like us in terms of their cellular activities. And if we look at that level, that microscopic level, we find that we're a lot like the fungi and the fungi are a lot like us. And so one can even make an argument that fungi have a very perhaps primitive, simple form of consciousness. That really is very, I find that absolutely fascinating. But really, when we look at the way that fungi react to their environment, when we tease them in some way, the way that they will grow differently, that like all organisms, this sensitivity is just part of all life. And so perhaps we're not so different from the fungi in the end.
Well, that's a great way to wrap up. And you've given us a lot to think about and helped us, I think, understand this world a little bit better. So thank you. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Our guest today has been Dr. Nicholas Money, mycologist, author, and professor of biology at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Thank you for listening to Between the Leaves at the Lloyd, a podcast of the Lloyd Library and Museum in Cincinnati, Ohio. Produced by Meg Hanrahan, with audio editing, mixing, and original music by Michael G. Ronstadt. If you want to learn more about the Lloyd and its collections, visit online anytime at lloydlibrary.org.